It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Ed Bott joins Jeff Jarvis. We've got a great panel for you. We'll be talking about the fact that Microsoft read one of its employees' email. Are they reading yours? We also have an inside look at Google's new watch, Android Wear, and Satoshi Nakamoto. Is it time for Newsweek to retract that story? It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 450, recorded March 23rd, 2014. Twitter Canoe and Ed Bott 2. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Jira, an Atlassian product. Jira is the project management solution for teams planning, building, and launching great products. To learn more about Jira and try it free for 30 days, visit Atlassian.com/twit. And by FreshBooks, the simple online accounting solution built for small business owners just like you who want to skip the headache of tax time. For a limited time, try FreshBooks free for 60 days. To get started, visit GetFreshBooks.com now and enter This Week in Tech in the How Did You Hear About Us section. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIT. And by audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Visit audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter, user ID audible_com. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we talk about the tech news in obsessive detail. Some might even say kind of obsessive detail. I can't think of another word for obsessive.
OCD. We're OCD.
Yeah, well, we are a little OCD. There he is, Mr. Jeff Jarvis, back from the voiceless. He had the Larry Page. Larry Page. And oddly enough, Larry Page started talking a lot, so I think there's some sort of weird...
There's only one voice between the two of us. Our voices are never in the same room at the same time.
Jeff is a professor of journalism at the City University of New York, the author of What Would Google Do and his latest Public Parts, and a regular on our This Week in Google program. Nice to see you, Jeff.
Good to see you.
Glad we can have you. Kind of make up for your voiceless.
This is a makeup quiz. Will you give me extra credit for staying after school and clean the eraser?
I will erase your incomplete.
Thank you.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we introduce you to Ed Bott, who we love dearly.
Well,
Ed has been on many times before. I've known him for more than 20 years now, Ed.
Each time we go through this, Leo, the list gets a little bit longer. The number gets a little bit higher.
He's the editor of the Ed Bott Report. He's actually Ed Bott of Ed Bott Report on ZDNet. Does a great job covering Microsoft, but of course, technology in general. And like those of us of a certain age, and this is the white-haired twit today, he's cynical and skeptical of much of what he sees in technology today. I think you have to be. Nice to have you, Ed. We appreciate it. We were talking before the show began. It's really kind of an old story, but I don't think we ever really followed up on the Newsweek cover story that proclaimed, Leah McGrath Goodman proclaimed that she had found the creator of Bitcoin hiding in plain sight in Southern California, Dorian Nakamoto. Nakamoto has issued 2 denials now. And you pointed me, Jeff Jarvis, to Felix Salmon's article on Reuters, Why Newsweek Isn't Convincing. This is from a couple of weeks ago. What is the latest? Here we are a month later from this cover story. And Newsweek stands by it, as does Goodman. Nobody has really proven otherwise, except there is an interesting email from the address that Nakamoto's used in the past, saying, I am not Dorian. But we know that...
3 denials. I think that's the latest. The latest is that Dorian has denied it twice. Mysterious Nakamoto has denied it, and Newsweek is standing by it. That's where it stands, I think.
Goodman says she has ample forensic evidence, which I'm not going to give you.
Jay Rosen wrote a very good piece, too, about this, following up on what Felix Salmon wrote and talked to Goodman. And a lot of it was this old attitude of the press, is that you should trust us because we're Newsweek. Well, for one thing, we don't do that anymore. And number another thing, you're not really Newsweek. You're just this strange ghost-like apparition.
Yeah, really.
After its death.
This was the return of Newsweek after it left the newsstand. Ars Technica, Joe Mullen writing in the Law and Disorder blog, the colossal arrogance of Newsweek's Bitcoin scoop. Without more evidence, it's time for a retraction, is it? Or at least for more evidence.
Yeah, well, I mean, right now the ball's in their court. This was their big coming out, right? Their reemergence after being, being under the control of new owners, and I mean, this is just one of the most spectacular swing and a miss attempts that I've ever seen in journalism. Really, seriously, to put this on the cover and then have all of your evidence fall apart, have all of your subjects deny it. And you continue to stand by the story without any additional evidence. That's just nuts. I've never seen. Can't really think of anything quite like it.
Well, I think Ed, we're seeing it about every 10 minutes these days on CNN as they talk about black holes and all kinds of ridiculous speculations as they have nothing to report but stay on the air 24 hours about the Malaysian Airlines flight. I think it's a little similar, actually.
Yeah.
They do at least keep changing their story there, coming up with new outlandish theories. This one is a single outlandish theory. Just nuts.
The interesting thing to me was that the argument around this story that interested me, that I didn't fully get to a decision about, was that a lot of the geeks said this was, what's the term on Reddit when you dox him? It was doxing the guy.
They doxed him, they're saying whether he's Nakamoto or not.
Well, that's the issue.
That's so cruel and unusual punishment.
Wrong, yeah. And violation and so on and so forth. Others were trying to say, on top of that, that it wasn't, his real identity is not newsworthy. And I've got to disagree with that. I think the real identity of the guy who potentially creates a nation-busting currency is newsworthy, and who he is and what's behind it does have some news value. Do you disagree with that? I mean, if it really were him, is that a story? Even if he says, I don't want to be known, I'm not involved anymore.
Oh, that's absolutely a story. In fact, what this reminds me of is the 1996 Olympics and Richard Jewell. Where there was the bombing in Atlanta.
Yeah, and he was falsely named as the bomber.
It turns out he was at the scene. He actually turned out to be a hero, and he was originally identified as a hero. And then one or two sources said, no, he's actually a suspect. And before you knew it, there was a rush to judgment. And so you have the analogy falls apart in a few cases, but it is the example of a guy who is thrust into the news against his will and has a false story told about him. And he doesn't get the chance to press the rewind button. He eventually won a fairly substantial and a fairly influential libel suit.
Yeah, Jewel sued NBC, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, got a formal apology. But I tell you what, you say the name Richard Jewell, and I think most people will go, oh, yeah, wasn't he the guy who
He died not in disgrace, but having had to spend most of the last years of his life just trying to clear his name.
Very sad.
This guy who got doxed is an old man, and he didn't ask for this. And, he doesn't seem to be in the best of health. And it seems like a profound act of cruelty to...
Well, wouldn't it be cruel even if he did invent Bitcoin?
If he did invent Bitcoin, if he did invent Bitcoin, he would be unspeakably rich and he would have access to medical care and housing and a standard of living and also a standard of defense that this guy doesn't. The fact that we haven't seen an army of lawyers descend on Newsweek yet is almost evidence that the guy is not him.
Yeah. In fact, I like this. Joe Mullen in Ars Technica calls it the Dewey beats Truman moment of the internet age.
Yeah.
It really is a case of, at this point, starting to smell. And I have to say, I maybe because I'm an old guy, I gave Newsweek credit. I gave Goodman credit. I thought, well, they would never have gone with this. They would have never... defended it if they didn't have compelling evidence.
But Newsweek is now owned by what is it, International Business Times, right?
Yeah.
IBT. And when I do our research every week for This Week in Google, a little plug there.
A lot of garbage.
Yeah, I see it's constantly there. Oh, confirmed new date for the Nexus 47.
Yeah.
And it's always from them. Always from them. And, you know, I'm all for free speech and everybody having their voice and all that. But if you want to try to call yourself a responsible institution of journalism, you got to act like it.
Well, I guess
Newsweek was previously owned by the Washington Post, right?
Right. Right.
Yes.
Okay. That's some serious journalistic cred. You get to spend that cred. If you've got it there, IBT, not so much.
I guess that's it. And I guess that I was fooled by the name Newsweek. Right.
Well, you know what that's like? There's brands like Polaroid and Izod and RCA that built up brand equity through the years. And then they went belly up,
right.
But their name got purchased by somebody else. And it's the same sort of thing. They bought and are squandering the equity that was in the Newsweek brand name.
Nothing new. Remember the Packard Bell computer?
Yeah.
They bought the old name, the old radio company, long out of business.
I want to start Alta Vista.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea. A new search engine.
Wonder who owns
just,
that?
And just resell them. Was Compaq? Results?
Who owns what? Alta Vista?
Yeah.
I don't know. Compaq, you think?
Alta Vista was a digital product.
Deck.
Compaq bought digital.
Nope, Yahoo.
HP bought Compaq.
Yahoo now owns Alta Vista?
I don't think I ever told you this story. I was Jeff Weiner was representing, who do you work for? Time Warner. And I was at Advance, and the two companies tried many years ago to buy Alta Vista. Thank God we failed. Major task force meetings and big documents and lots of lawyers, and we were going to buy Alta Vista and do wonderful things in this amazing world of search.
Well, you know, this whole idea of having a web search engine isn't a bad idea. Really, I mean, some have made it.
Yeah.
It's I don't know what make Google succeed over Alta Vista. They were there first. Everybody used Alta Vista till Google came along.
Alta Vista was, I mean, Google was better.
Was that it? They were better?
Yeah, they really were. They were better.
I guess so. They were cleaner. They were simpler.
Well,
they didn't have ads.
They didn't have a business model at first, but they had the page rank made a difference.
Yeah. And we talked about this on This Week in Google this week, but they have now, they have ads. If you search for something, a good one would be mesothelioma. That's the one Danny Sullivan suggested. Google has changed how ads look on the main search page. And this is one of the reasons we left Alta Vista, was it was not clear what was a search result, what was an ad. They do have a yellow ad button.
I think that's clearer, Leo, than it used to.
But they no longer have the box. They had a box. And
it didn't just say ad word. Now it says ad. How much clearer do you want?
Well, look on the right hand. But wait a minute, Jeff. Look on the right hand column where it does say ads at the top. But as I scroll down, those ads are indistinguishable from the actual results.
Because we're trained now to know the right-hand column.
We know that that's an ad column.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with native advertising is you call it things like brand voice. You don't use the A word.
Right.
Google's using the A word.
At least they say it's an ad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I'll get accused of sucking up to Google. I'm not. I think using the word ad is the most important thing you can do, to be clear.
All right. I'll grant you that.
You needed me on Twig this week.
We did. You would have defended this.
Yes.
Well, there's a balancing act that all of the advertising and search companies do when it comes to presenting their results. They want the ads to be identifiable, but in as
unidentifiable a way
a
as
fashion
possible.
as is legally possible, right? Because the difference if you can credibly mislead some of your audience that and 1% of people your click rate will go up by 1%. That's a fortune.
Right.
That's, you know, if you can boost your click rate, and it's all about getting people to click those ads. That's where the money comes from.
So there's if you do it once, always a balancing act. But in the long run, if you keep fooling people, you know, quote P.T. Barnum.
Yeah.
And it won't work. Did we talk about this? Because I guess we didn't. Tony Hale of Chartbeat did a wonderful column in Time.
We did talk about that. That was a great column.
Right. And so, Ed, the point of that is that people are recognizing that native advertising is crap and they're not scrolling it. They're going to the page and leaving it. And so, thank goodness, the public is smart.
Yeah.
We're not fooling.
Yeah.
Yeah. In aggregate, we are smart.
In aggregate. Individually, yeah. We're pretty dumb. We've seen it all before. Turkey is starting to ban social media. We'll talk about that and Google's fight against it, which is good, in just a little bit. But first, and we've got a great panel. We're glad to have Ed Bott and Jeff Jarvis here to talk about the week's tech news on Twit. But first, a word from a company that I knew about and a product I'd heard about, but I didn't really know what it did. We're talking about Atlassian and Jira. Jira is one of the world's most powerful and customizable issue and project management systems. Now, that's not something I need to pay attention to, but if you do, you want to pay attention to this. Atlassian.com/twit will allow you to easily capture and organize and prioritize your team's issues, tasks, features, and bugs. Give your team a simple, intuitive interface for collaborating with others in real time. You can integrate your planning documents wherever they're from, which I really like. You can use the tool you like, integrate it in your backlog, your issues, your code repository. Choose the code repository you prefer. Set up any business process you can imagine so your team works the way you want. Define your own issue types to track the information that matters most to your team. Stay in the loop. You've got notifications via email, chat. You can even use at replies or RSS and monitor streams of activity or self-updating reports and dashboards. You're always in the know. Expand infinitely in any direction with thousands of Jira add-ons. When you've got a platform that is this popular, that's been around for this long, there's so many choices. There's test management, time tracking, project management, hundreds of uses. And, of course, with code, Jira ties everything together from the initial planning doc, the files, the change sets, right there in your code repository all the way through deployment. Of course, they support REST APIs. They work with Git. They're flexible. They're simple enough for a 5-person startup, powerful and reliable enough for a 100,000-person enterprise. That's why over 25,000 companies, 70% of the Fortune 100, even NASA, uses Jira, J-I-R-A. It sits at the heart of Atlassian's offerings for managing your entire app development process from concept to launch. Go to Atlassian, Atlassian.com/twit to learn more about Jira. Monthly plans, very affordable, $10 a month for up to 10 users, and it's free for 30 days when you use Atlassian.com/twit. Push that try it free button. It's funny, I was talking, my son Henry came home from college, and we were talking about advertising. And he said, you know, Edgar Bernays, you ever hear of him? I said, yeah, Edgar Bernays. He said, Freud's nephew, yeah, who invented modern-day advertising. And I said, yeah, Henry, that's right. And that's why we don't do ads the same way we used to do it in the old days, where we'd scare people or, you know, use their secret needs, wants, and desires to sell a product. You know, what we do on Twit is so different. We tell you about the product, the features, the benefits, and then we let you try it for free. And I think that's kind of old-fashioned, but I really like how we do that. He said, yeah, Edgar Bernays. Fascinating fella. Let's talk about Turkey. When we were in Turkey, when, Lisa? Not so long ago, a few months ago. And at the time, our guides, a lot of the people we were talking to, especially the women, were very concerned about a return in Turkey to Sharia law, the rise of the Muslim government. Of course, there were the protests that in Tahrir Square. But not Tahrir. What's the name of the square in Turkey? Tahrir's in Egypt, right?
Chat room, please.
But of course, as with Egypt, as with the Egypt Spring, the Arab Spring, Twitter and social media, very, very powerful in this kind of stuff. Prime Minister Erdogan banned Twitter late Thursday night in Turkey. And of course, the immediate effect was people started tweeting more than ever before, getting around the ban using VPNs and other technical strategies.
Well, the great thing was there was a movement of graffiti putting up Google's DNS.
Isn't that great?
8888 and 4488.
Right. On the walls, painting them.
On walls, painting yeah. all over. Which, of course, couldn't last that long because then the next thing happened was the Turkey blocked.
They started doing blocks of the DNS. Because the first thing they did was to block it in the DNS system, the Turkish DNS system, and obviously that didn't work. So they started blocking DNS options, including Google's, by Saturday, by last night. Look at that. 8.8.8.8. Who would have ever thought you would see that as graffiti on a wall?
Yeah. Isn't that cool?
But it just shows you, you try to block this stuff, you do so at your own peril. It can actually make it worse.
Certainly, if you're starting out in a country that is open, that has a tradition of open communication, when you have to ratchet things down and shut them off, there's too many pipes, too many tubes.
Yep.
That you gotta deal with. There, it's much easier in a country where the state already controls the means of communication, the incoming pipe to the country,
like China. Yeah,
like China, as and I think in Libya, when that was happening a couple of years ago, it's a lot easier in an environment like that. But introducing repression into a country that's used to Western style communication is kind of doomed to fail. It's not going to succeed. And interestingly, I'm going to be visiting Turkey in about, I think, 5 weeks or so. So I'll get a chance to see how things have.
I was speaking there in June myself.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder what it'll be like. Twitter Schmitter, apparently, is what Prime Minister Erdogan said. The translation, rough translation of Twitter and Twitter.
I just retweeted a cartoon for your benefit there, Leo.
All right.
It's from a Dutch newspaper. It's okay. You can put it on.
Uh-oh. And
yeah, because I can't read the – wow.
No, nobody can read the caption. But
it's pretty obvious if you look at the picture. It's birds pooping. Twitter birds pooping on
Erdogan. I think the caption on the cartoon, someone told me, is in Dutch and says Turkish spring.
Yuck. Wow.
Yeah,
if you're interested in the story, I highly recommend Zeynep Tufekci, Zeynep. Sociologist, Princeton and UNC, who's just really, really good at that. She's Turkish, and she knows her stuff well. She knows social really well. I'd follow her.
Of course, lots of traffic on Twitter about this. Can this work?
No. In the long run, it cannot. Proven. Can't.
Yeah. As you say, when you're coming from a country where freedom of expression has already, you know, once you show them Twitter, how are you going to keep them down on the farm?
I don't think it's just freedom of expression. It's having a multitude of channels for that. So one of the first things that people said you can do is you can text your tweets.
Right.
Now, you might not be able to read things from other people, but you can publish stuff to Twitter immediately by enabling it on your SMS feed, and then boom, you just send something to a particular number and it's on Twitter. You've just bypassed it. So you have so many, again, it's not a repressive country in general. They don't have an iron-fisted control over the communication channels. So how do you block all of them? There's right. way too many.
Right. Actually, Zeynep tweets, so much awful analysis of Turkey's Twitter block coming out. I guess it's big enough news to attract those stylized fact-light analyses. So I don't want to be one of those. But
she wrote a wonderful piece during the Innocence of the Muslims brouhaha, as she puts it, about, and I use her words here, why free speech is baffling to many. That the idea that this speech could come out of the country seems like it's endorsed, because normally speech is approved.
Yeah.
And if you live in a country where speech is approved, then to see it come out in a country like ours where it's not, you assume that it's approved, and thus it represents what the view is. And that's a lot of what, in her argument, leads to the different worldviews around something like the Innocence of the Muslims.
She writes in Medium, the day the Turkish government banned itself from Twitter, people in Turkey have banned the ban. She says that during the day, Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan had said, Twitter Schmitter will wipe them all off. I don't care what the international community says. She says, I had muttered, you might care what the people in Turkey will think. Twitter is not just a protest tool in Turkey, nor just a place where the growing corruption scandal is discussed. It's also used by a large number of government supporters, including almost all of the leading officials and parliamentarians from the ruling party. It's an entrenched part of the network public sphere. She thought it was perhaps it was a glitch. It doesn't make any sense. What happened next should be a lesson to any modern country that wants to ban social media after it's already been incorporated into everyday life. For the next 3 hours, I slowly watched my turkey list on Twitter go from quiet to resurgent to defiant to jubilant to very, very crowded. People circumvented one by one and then in a flood. You can't shut it down. People in Turkey had banned the ban. So, in fact, the only people who really got banned from Twitter are the pro-government tweeters who didn't want to openly circumvent. They, in effect, shut down their supporters while amplifying their critics. Whoops. The only people not on Twitter at the moment, she writes, are ardent pro-government supporters who do not want to circumvent and people who may not have the fairly minimal skill required to circumvent.
Who are most likely not exactly in your active Twitter community anyway.
She says people are also backing up their networks to WhatsApp, to Viber, to Facebook, and whatever else I probably don't even know about. The country is fairly wired. Massive media censorship of the past few years has meant social media as a lifeline many have adopted. That's interesting. So official censorship of the official media and of the press has merely amplified the importance of social media. Seems like you try to shut this stuff down, it just squeezes around.
Barbara Streisand's you.
Yeah, the Barbara Streisand effect. Yeah. And then the official tweet from the official government agency of Turkey, Twitter was blocked to prevent abusive rights. okay.
Yeah. Something got lost in translation there.
And her last sentence in this piece in Medium, finally, the circumvention has become so normalized, I'm once again seeing people tweet about food, cats, and the weather. So there you go. The only effect of the ban, the government banned from Twitter. That's kind of fitting, isn't it?
Now, I'm worried. There's a story in here, too. The speculation that, and I don't know, it may be just rank speculation, it may be nothing, but Twitter trying to get rid of what Vivian Schiller calls its infrastructure of RTs and hashtags.
Yeah, that's terrible. This comes from The Guardian.
Yeah, I want to be careful. Well, The Guardian and elsewhere. I want to be careful with speculation, and so I don't know if it's true. But, hey, this is like CNN. We might as well speculate.
That's our job. Vivian Schiller, who's their Twitter's new head of news, and maybe she's just not up to speed. I don't know. She just came there recently.
She just came there about a month ago. Yeah. Vivian's very smart. She's good.
Oh, yeah. She said at a media conference that the @reply and the hashtag were arcane, and she said that Twitter was working on a way to hide them while retaining functionality. We are working on moving the scaffolding of Twitter into the background. It is a little arcane, but I think everybody gets it now.
It is but look how people used it to gather around and do things. They created movements around the hashtag, and so there was an example of one design that there was one small test evidently that if I replied to you, it just didn't have the @ sign, but it was still tied to you.
Right.
It was tied to you in their client as data. It may not be as apparent. I don't know. But again, I'm speculating. So I understand on the one hand the geekiness is off-putting, and Twitter desperately wants to grow its audience. On the other hand, look at the power of what the hashtag has done. It led to Occupy Wall Street. It led to FU Washington. It led to, you know, all these things. Am I being a geek hankering for something that is too arcane and is too much of us? Or am I right to worry that this...
I wouldn't worry about this. This sounds like one of those things. Maybe they're floating a trial balloon.
What it sounds like to me? You only have 140 characters, and one of the most interesting things to see on Twitter is when somebody gets a good Twitter canoe going, right?
What's a Twitter canoe?
A Twitter canoe is when you have so many names involved in the conversation that there's no room
for
left
content
for actual content.
Did you make that up? That's good.
Oh no. It's been around for a while. And in fact, sometimes people do it on purpose. You start adding people on to the end of a discussion, or you know, people just come in themselves. So the same thing. So when you have at signs and names. You know, Jeff Jarvis is takes up about 10 characters plus the at sign is 11 characters plus the space before that. That's 12 characters, and boom, I'm out of that. Whereas I can have a more substantive conversation with at Ev than I can with at Jeff Jarvis or at Leo Laporte, because your names are interfering and using up some of the content space.
But who's in the conversation, Ed, matters. So when I see somebody...
Absolutely. But if the idea is to remove the names from the character count and still leave them visible in the conversation, that makes perfect sense. And it also makes perfect sense that somebody would botch the description of that when they're bringing it up in a place where it hasn't been approved by marketing, or it hasn't been fully thought through yet.
Right. Yeah. Maybe they just won't count them for a long time. People said 140 characters. It's so arbitrary. It doesn't make sense. Why don't we have more? That's one way to give you more characters while preserving the content, is make the hashtags and the at replies free, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, here's an example of a tweet with 1, 2, 3, 4 names. He says, I don't know which voice is Ed. I think Ed sounds distinct. Ed, from now on, would you introduce everything by saying, this is Ed? I'm just kidding.
I'll see if I can get, what's his name?
This is CNN.
This is, and now Ed will speak.
Here's another one. From Bill, watching the white-haired twit with Leo Laporte and guest Jeff Jarvis, Ed Bott with OMG Chad producing. You're right. It becomes that's a canoe. I like it. A Twitter canoe and Ed Bott too.
Yeah. So, you know, go ahead and reply to that and throw another name in there.
Yeah.
Let's make a canoe out of this. I love that. I don't know why I'd never heard that. That's a great word.
Twitter
is 8 years old, by the way, this week. And they're celebrating in a variety of ways. You can see what your first tweet is and so forth.
I'm pretty sure they got my first tweet wrong. According to them, my first tweet is something like, I'm installing Vista Service Pack 1 on a test machine. But I distinctly remember what they list as my second tweet being my first one, which is something along the lines of, why would anyone care what the hell I had for lunch?
This is in the Discover page. Yeah, discover.twitter.com. You put your first tweet in. They've definitely got mine wrong, but that's not their fault. I joined Twitter in December 2006 and then quit Twitter in April 2007 and rejoined in November. So this is
same here.
This is the first tweet from my second attempt.
Okay, I'm trying Twitter again.
Right. You can tell. I said, I surrender Twitter, you win. I give up. Well, the reason I quit was because I was concerned about copyright confusion between Twit and Twitter, and I thought, this is when you could not be on Twitter, easily not be on Twitter. And I went to Jaiku and used something else, and nobody ever followed me. Jaiku went under. Google bought him. So I think it was actually iJustine who convinced me, no, you really should be on Twitter. I think something's going on there. So they got yours wrong. How could they get yours wrong, Ed, though? It just seems like...
It could be also that my memory is wrong, but I pretty distinctly, there it is. I've heard people say that there were problems with date timestamps in the first couple of years, and Lord knows they were making a lot of it up on the server side as they went along back then.
Chewing gum and string, baby.
In the second year, as they started to hit the hockey stick portion of the curve, the fail whale came out a lot then.
Remember that?
So I've only seen it once recently.
So Twitter's trying some interesting things. For instance, it seems to be an experiment. It's on the Twitter iOS client for some. How many people saw a tweet?
Which is brave of them, actually, because I think it's far fewer than anyone imagines.
It is interesting, but I think it would be kind of important step if you wanted to, like, let advertisers know what their impressions were. I haven't seen it. I don't use Twitter, the Twitter client, so I haven't seen it yet. It is brave, isn't it? The woman Lydia J, whose Twitter we're looking at, told The Verge. She says, "This just gives me anxiety." Like, oh, that tweet sucked. It got zeroed views. Well, I don't. It's not the content of the tweet that tells you how many views you got, or is it? Maybe if it gets retweeted, I guess it would.
Well, maybe but there's a point there. Maybe it leads to the buzzfeedification of Twitter.
Yes. Oh, let's
people
do
go
that.
Crazier.
Let's make it really. Let's everybody kind of try to get more tweets views.
Well, at least temporarily, what it would do would be to shift the effort of the scammers and crooks from creating and buying and selling fake followers into creating and buying and selling fake readers, fake viewers. Yeah. Which,
oh, no.
I mean, that's, well, look, it happened to the web.
Yeah.
It happened to email marketing. It happened, and it happened to Facebook, I'm pretty sure, along the way. And as Twitter starts to monetize itself more, you're going to see it here too. I mean, every online economy attracts people who want to exploit and take their unfair share.
Well, that's interesting.
Out of that economy.
That's a very good point. It's just the way it happens.
Yeah.
And then we find ways to fight it.
So you have so an increasing amount of resources at websites, at web ad serving companies, and now at services like Twitter, certainly at iTunes and the Google Play Store, they're constantly having to work to defeat people who are trying to game the review system,
right?
And move things up the chart. So there's a constant cat and mouse game between people who are selling stuff online and especially people who are selling attention or presence online, and those who are trying to extract an unfair share out of it.
I get a lot of emails now from people. I guess Google's cracking down on spammy links because I've suddenly started. We have a little used forums site, the Commons, Twit Commons. And I guess for a while, a lot of people were spamming it. And so lately, I've been getting these great emails from people saying, "Appears our previous SEO company has created some pages with links back to our website. We've been advised by Google these links are against their terms. We need to remove them. And if we don't, we're going to use the disavowal tool. That could be detrimental to your website. So can you take our spam links down?" So I immediately sent a response saying, "It just makes me so happy to know that your spammy crap on my website is getting you in trouble. Go ahead, try to disavow me. Try."
Well, why not say you'd be happy to remove their spammy links? Your customary charge
for the
administrative time is $1 per link removed.
Oh, that's great.
With a $100 service fee for each job.
Yeah.
$100 minimum,
right,
plus $1 for each link.
Should you say, I bet it would work. I could make some money off of this.
I don't see why not. And I honestly, if you're actually going to assign somebody in your, you're going to have to pay an employee or at least assign a paid employee.
This is
time
a lot of work.
Yeah.
I'm getting a lot of removal requests.
I'll take a commission on that
deal. You thought of the idea. I'll give you 50 cents for every one of those. I'm getting a ton of these.
I got a business idea here.
You do. Google has manually penalized my site for having unnatural links. I don't know how these links got on Twit Town Commons. Did you put them there, you moron?
Or they paid someone.
They paid somebody. Right.
Yeah. They paid an SEO specialist.
Oh, Lord. To spam my forums.
Well, but you already know they'll pay.
I know.
And that their online reputation is important enough for them to pay. So they pay putting them in there. They could pay to take them out.
Chatroom says it sounds vaguely illegal, but that's the best money-making scams. They sound vaguely illegal, but they're not. No. Glenn, could you get right on that? $100 removal fee plus $1 per link. Love it. We'll send 50 cents to Ed for each and every link we remove. I love that.
You can send it to me in Bitcoin.
Actually, we should just take Bitcoin. Is Bitcoin going up or down? Anybody know?
There was another exchange that I don't know whether it collapsed. I only saw the headline sort of scrolling by today. But there was another exchange that is in trouble.
Yeah.
And
I'm surprised Google doesn't tell you the value by just putting it in Bitcoin.
Yeah. Mt. Gox is now asking people to sign in with their account to see their balance. So maybe Gox, which has declared...
They found 200,000 Bitcoin.
They found a few.
Another 600,000 missing, I think.
Yeah.
Great. This is, you know, someone needs to remake It's a Wonderful Life with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was one on the bank.
Oh, fool, you lost 200,000 Bitcoin at the Starbucks when you tipped the barista 200,000 Bitcoins.
Lord. Oh, man. Twitter Music is dead. You know, this. Everybody was very excited about this when this came out.
I don't even remember it.
Yeah, you don't? Oh, I do. There was an app, and the idea was your friends, what they were listening to, they would tweet them, and then you would you'd have kind of a conversation going around and so forth. The app will cease working on April 18th. They've removed it from the App Store. And so there you go. Twitter Music, which nobody used, is dead.
So it was tied with one service, RDO, was it?
Was it RDO? Okay.
I'd have to go back. But then that service got sold to...
We Are Hunted, which Twitter acquired. I never heard of We Are Hunted. Yeah. And then the app integrated with Spotify and RDO, recommending tracks based on tracks... on artists you had followed and tweeted about. Members of the team We Are Hunted have since left Twitter, although the founder remains there. Anyway.
I believe that's called taking the money.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. So you remember that warning that we got from the federal government not to use Huawei equipment because the Chinese were spying on us? It turns out we were spying back on them. We'll have that story in just a little bit. Also... Well, there's lots to talk about. I want to talk about this Android Wear and Google's bid to get into the wearables space and a whole lot more. EdBot is here from the EdBot Report on ZDNet. Anything else you want to plug, Ed?
Geez, I got nothing right now.
You got a book, anything?
Got no books.
Nothing.
Just go to ZDNet. I've had some really interesting stuff there.
I feel really inadequate when I have nothing new to plug.
I know. What are you doing here? You know. Sunday afternoon, don't you have something to do?
It's not football season.
It's right. Yeah, it's a lot harder to get people during the NFL season. March Madness, I guess, a little easier. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. If you are not using FreshBooks and you're starting to get ready for tax time, oy, I feel your pain. FreshBooks is an online accounting system that just will simplify your life. You don't have to hunt for receipts and dig through invoices, going through your records. You got that shoebox with all the paper in it. No, you need FreshBooks. It's a simple cloud accounting solution that makes tax time a breeze. You can sign up for free at getfreshbooks.com. I started using FreshBooks 10 years ago now. I'm kind of amazed to do my invoicing. It was the easiest way. I would get paid faster. They keep track of time and hours. You can get real-time business reports with a couple of clicks. Track your expenses. Mobile apps for your phone and tablet make it really easy. The sooner you start using FreshBooks, the sooner you can start focusing on the work you love and not on your paperwork. Focus on your work, not on your paperwork. I was so glad when I started invoicing with FreshBooks. I got paid faster. It handled different currencies because I was billing into Canada. It just was really great. For a limited time, you could try FreshBooks free for 60 days, 2 months free, when you visit getfreshbooks.com. And if they ask you, where did you hear about us, put This Week in Tech in, all right? 60-day free trial from FreshBooks, getfreshbooks.com. Mention This Week in Tech when they say, how did you hear about us? You can put TWIT. Four letters is enough. Getfreshbooks.com. I really like this. If you're in business for yourself, everything counts. Everything helps. What do you think, Ed? We talked with Steve Gibson this week, and he said, you know, the XP thing is overblown. April 8th is the last patch Tuesday for Windows XP. Finally, after 13 years, Microsoft says we're not going to fix it anymore. You know, on the one hand, you see all these breathless reports. 95% of all U.S. ATMs use Windows XP. 500 million users will be vulnerable to hacking. I've called it, you know, it could be Armageddon on April 9th. But then Steve calmed me down a little bit. He said, you know, if you know what you're doing, you can still run XP safely. Where do you come down on that?
Oh, I think Steve is right. I mean, on security issues, he usually is, and I don't think there's any question that he's got it here too. ATMs in general are single purpose devices on dedicated networks, either VPNs or direct dial up connections to a banking network. People get viruses and malware by surfing the web and reading email and, you know, either opening attachments or going to dodgy websites on unpatched machines. You're not going to do that on an ATM. The fact that an ATM is running Windows XP is, you know, basically kind of irrelevant.
Yeah.
So I'm not worried about ATMs. Among the rest of the people, the overwhelming majority of instances of malware infection these days are coming through vulnerabilities in third-party products, things like Flash, Acrobat, and especially Java.
Yeah,
those are the places where. And again, you're not running those things. If you're running those things and you're keeping them up to date, even on an XP machine, you're not going to be exploited. In addition, you have antivirus software that will continue to be supported from third parties and even from Microsoft for a period after XP goes out of support. So yeah, you know, if you're running XP, I think you're making a bad decision. There are a lot better choices that you can make. You know, and
Steve runs XP. He loves XP.
Yeah,
he's not even using Service Pack 3.
Jesus.
Yeah.
He said I couldn't patch it after Service Pack 2, so I said I'll forget it. But he admittedly knows what he's doing. He's behind a firewall. He doesn't.
Yeah,
I doubt Steve opens any attachments. I don't think he even gets HTML mail at all.
No, he probably reads his mail in a terminal.
Yeah,
Pine.
Later.
Yeah,
in Pine.
Pine.
Right.
Yeah. You can't click a link in Pine.
And uses links to surf the web, you know, which is a.
But I have to say, most of the people are using XP, and some of these people bought XP on netbooks just a few years ago. It's not all 13-year-old machines. Some of these people using XP, in fact, I would say probably the majority of them, are not sophisticated users. And so the fact that they can't update Internet Explorer, the fact that they won't be getting patches, they're going to be pretty vulnerable.
Well, there hasn't been a netbook sold from a manufacturer with XP on it since 2009. And
so
you
5 years.
And that's five full years.
Well, I think that's about the age of my father's.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even then, you knew then that you were buying a dying product, and you were paying.
That's like my father.
You were cheap.
You were paying $300. You were paying $300 for a product. You got your use out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's time. You liking Windows 8?
I've been running Windows 8.1 Update 1, which will be available to the public in a few weeks.
Yeah.
And I have to say, a lot of the issues with Windows 8. Was very, very difficult to use. I have a dual monitor system here. Windows 8 was practically unusable on dual monitors. Windows 8.1 improved that tremendously. 8.1 Update 1 makes it even easier to use. So I think it's one of those slow motion improvement processes that, you know, it will improve again at the end of this year, and it will improve again next year. But I understand completely people who say, not yet.
Yeah. Well, and there are a lot of people, I think, who use XP because they have line of business software or vertical applications that only run an XP. They were never
very
updated.
Very few. I think there are very few of those.
I hope you're right.
There really are. In
all
most
of
cases,
them call my radio show, I might add.
Of course,
every
they
one
are.
Of them.
Of course, they do. I mean, there are people who are using an old version of QuickBooks books, for example.
He called today, Quicken. They were using Quicken. He says, when I updated from Windows 98 to Windows XP, I can't import the data now.
Yeah.
Today, he called me. This is like a call from when you used to be on Dvorak on Computers with me. This is like the land that time forgot.
Wow. You just want to say, okay, find your serial ports.
Do you have your dongle, sir? No, I lost it.
Well, I think there's a serious issue here, which is that there's a certain segment of the population that has been trained to believe that entire experiences should be completely free.
Yeah.
There should be no cost ever associated with them.
Yeah.
And that's led to the bad experiences that people have with software.
Yeah.
But Ed, I think this gets obsoleted as an argument, and pardon me for this, but I'm from the cloud show. I come down from the cloud. By the cloud, if I were introducing a grandparent to stuff today, you'd introduce them to Docs, and you'd introduce them to...
It'd be so much easier, wouldn't it?
And it's so much easier.
Would probably be a better choice for those people, too.
Yeah.
Hey, we got some feedback, and then we weren't able to hear you. I think your USB either fell out, or...
Why don't we work with Ed, and I'll do a commercial. How about that?
Sounds
good. We always know there's a problem when one of our hosts goes... He's like, his hands are out. He's like, hello? We'll figure it out, Ed. Oh, God, he's gone. A puff of smoke, greasy black smoke. He's disappeared. Our show today brought to you, this is a good opportunity to talk about Squarespace while Chad pushes some buttons. One of the things I like about Squarespace is Squarespace sites never go down. You never have these kinds of problems because they're running the hosting and they're running the software. On top of it, they keep it up to date constantly. They keep it secure. You don't have to worry about that. A better web starts with your website and Squarespace.com. You go to the Squarespace.com site, click the Get Started button. You'll immediately be presented with 25 gorgeous templates. You might say, well, that's hardly enough. Are there only 25 different kinds of sites? No, because every single template is just the starting point. They build the latest technology into this. You don't have to know it, but they have HTML5, CSS. They're doing the latest technology, but including mobile responsive design, so the site looks great no matter how big the screen, including commerce in each and every template. In fact, if you just click a link to one of the templates, you'll see other sites using that template, and they all look unique. They're all... Here's the Game of Thrones, the exhibition. This is interesting. An exhibit of Game of Thrones. So they're using this template because of the great images. And the beauty part is it's going to look good on an iPhone up to a 30-inch display. Take a look at the different sites, what people are doing with these templates. And the beauty is you don't have to be an expert. You can drag and drop, point and click your way to that beautiful site. And if you want some help, they have the best support. Regular winners of Stevie Awards for top-of-the-line support, live chat and email support 24/7. Completely redesigned customer help site, so you've got easy access to the articles, the video workshops. And when you talk to a support person at Squarespace.com, you're talking to somebody in New York on-site that actually works at Squarespace. Really gorgeous stuff. Squarespace.com. E-commerce is now available in all the plans. Now, admittedly, the $8 a month plan, you can only sell one thing, but wait, that means it would be good for a school fundraiser. It'd be good for a cash wedding registry for nonprofits. $8 a month when you sign up for the annual plan includes a custom domain. And like I said, you can e-commerce as well. For $24 a month, you get a full e-commerce solution, including real-time carrier shipping, label printing via ShipStation, integrated accounting. There's a great developer platform if you do know CSS and JavaScript and all of that. And the higher-end plans have unlimited bandwidth, unlimited storage, unlimited contributors and blogs, unlimited pages, unlimited galleries. I mean, you're really getting a lot for your money. The great apps that let you post, the blog app lets you make text updates, drag and drop images to change layouts and monitor comments on the go. The metric app allows you to check site stats like page views, unique visitors, social media followers. They've got the logo designer. They just keep getting better and better and better. I want you to try it right now. Squarespace.com includes the hosting and everything else. Visit Squarespace.com. 2 weeks free. You do not have to use a credit card. You could just try it for free for 2 weeks. You get the free Typekit fonts, the free Google fonts, custom CSS if you want, complete SEO, the good kind, not the bad kind, video, images, social connections. It can easily import your content from everywhere, including Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Foursquare, 500px, or Flickr. The layout engine. Try it today. Squarespace.com. Click the Get Started button. And then, if you decide to buy, please use This Week in Tech, or, I'm sorry, TWIT as the offer code, and you'll get 10% off your new site. Squarespace.com. We got Ed back.
I'm back, baby.
Yeah, baby.
Hey, Ed, get a Chromebook.
You're not using a Chromebook right now, Jeff, are you?
Well, that's only because of you.
Yeah, I make him use a Mac just for Skype.
And by the way, the camera went out and I had to switch machines. It's already been out twice.
Hey, let me mention, as long as we're talking about Google and Chrome and everything, a little plug for a Google event with Vint Cerf that's coming up April 2nd.
Ooh.
And I'm actually hoping that I can be a part of it. I've offered to moderate it. They are doing a hangout with Vint Cerf, the father of the internet. He doesn't like to be called that. He is. He is.
Neither does Ollie.
Apparently, yeah. Nobody likes it. Okay,
oh,
bad
it's
dog.
Not Ollie. It's the bigger dog. Yes.
Never a dull moment here.
No, that's good. I like it. If you go to, let me see, I got to find the link. I think it's google.com/takeaction. You can take a part in this hangout. You can ask questions of the father of the internet. And the whole deal on this is they want to talk about not Google, but the preserving the freedom of the internet, preserving net neutrality, and all this.
Google's calling him a father of the internet, so I think you can do it.
Yeah, I've interviewed Vint many times before, and he says, I was one of the fathers. The internet has many fathers, but you know what? He is increasingly like the guy, isn't he? Don't we all love him?
Yep, we do.
Freedom to participate, free expression, freedom from unwarranted intrusion. Google, take action. And that's coming up April 2nd. I'm hoping to be part of that. And
well, I hope
we're hoping
you are.
We can rebroadcast
it. Perfect to do that.
I'd love to do it. And I have volunteered the Googleplex. And now I'm getting the tattoo and the special serial number implant, and I'll be ready. No, I'm just joking. See, now I'm not going to get to do it. That was just a joke. NSA has breached Huawei for years. The federal government says don't use Huawei equipment because Huawei is owned partially by the Chinese government. But as we found out now, what comes around goes around. The NSA has been creating its own backdoors right into Huawei's networks, according to information by Edward Snowden. The operation codenamed Shot Giant was looking for links between the People's Liberation Army and Huawei to exploit Huawei's technology, so when the company sold equipment to other countries, the NSA could roam through those networks freely. NSA's good at this. Unbelievable.
It is amazing. Now, there's some controversy. Evidently, there's some controversy about the story being revealed. The New York Times did the story.
Right.
And Glenn Greenwald has been defending Snowden. People are arguing with Snowden. And Greenwald says, don't blame Snowden. Snowden handed things to journalists. The New York Times decided what to reveal and not to reveal. Greenwald agrees with them revealing this. So do I. I think it's hypocritical as hell. They went after Huawei and turns out that they themselves are drilling into the Huawei equipment. Snowden himself, you know, has long since given up the documents and control of them.
You know, Claire Kane Miller had an article that appeared in the New York Times that initially the headline of the article was Edward Snowden revelations cost U.S. tech companies. I saw your tweet. That's how I found out about it. They've changed the headline. Revelations of NSA spying cost U.S. tech companies. Snowden, I would just take that revelations off and just say NSA spying.
Exactly. I don't know if you saw Snowden was I quite disliked Snowden's interview at South by Southwest. It had the problem South by Southwest keynote interviews always have where the interviewers take too much time. So TED, and I've made fun of TED, I will confess, but I give big credit to Chris Anderson from TED. He interviewed Snowden as a traveling bot as Sheldon Cooper at TED this year. And it was a really good interview because he gave Snowden the time to talk. And Snowden is now in his coming out phase. Really interesting, I think, where he's talking about why he did what he did, why he would do it again, why he defends the Constitution, how he handed things over to the journalists. He doesn't talk about things unless the journalists have decided to reveal them.
Right.
Really, really interesting talk. Half an hour, I'd recommend.
That was just at TED.
Just at TED 3 days ago, yeah.
I'll have to watch it.
And it was followed by what was also an interesting presentation from a representative of the NSA who made quite a decent defense of their activities and did a better job than his bosses have been doing for the past few years.
So, yeah, so the 60 Minutes piece was just such a puff piece that I think it hurt their credibility. So what did the NSA representative say?
I'm not up to date enough on what exactly he said. I'd be doing a disservice to the community by trying to summarize it. But I think it was a good set of bookends that if you're going to watch one, you should watch the other because they were done on the same day, as I recall, or one day apart. And they were very specifically done with the idea of being not so much a debate as two sides of the same issue, and both were well done.
Apparently, Chris Anderson said, as Snowden appeared, if the NSA wants to respond, please do. And so NSA Deputy Director Richard Leggett answered Anderson's questions the next day. Yeah. I will absolutely watch that. And obviously,
while we're on the topic, I also recommend Snowden submitted written testimony and written answers to questions to the EU. And his opening statement is very, very good.
Is the tenor changing about Edward Snowden? I know there are many who still think he was a traitor and probably the NSA would love to have him in jail for life. But it seems that maybe the tenor of the conversation is changing a little bit.
I think it is. And I think that's why he was, I don't want to make this into a cynical analysis. I don't mean this in any way, but it couldn't have been handled better by the world's best PR guy. Snowden handed it over, came out and opened, didn't play cat and mouse with the world, said, I'm the guy who did this. This is why I did this. Gave a video statement, disappeared, waited out the whole Russia thing. Russia wasn't his fault. People are quick to point out that he was stopped there by the Americans, essentially. Didn't bring anything with him to Russia. Insists he has nothing there to hand over to them. Waits this out. And then now comes out South by Southwest, EU, and TED, and comes off as, I think, a very thoughtful, reasonable, caring, patriotic American, in my view. And obviously my views on the story are apparent. But I think that, I think he waited for the moment when the tide had shifted enough that he could support that changing view of him.
It's really interesting to watch the chat room because there is quite a difference of opinion. In fact, one right after the other. He's an American hero. He's absolutely a traitor. There's great amount of disagreement over Snowden.
Oh, yeah. And
in our chat room, a lot of people think he's a traitor. On the other hand, I feel like the information that we got from him, some of it we knew, but a lot we didn't. And the extent of spying on U.S. citizens is rather dramatic. Mark Zuckerberg and other tech execs, including Eric Schmidt, met on Friday with President Obama to talk about this very issue. Zuckerberg has slammed the White House for working too slowly on NSA reform. Reed Hastings of Netflix, Dropbox, Box, Palantir, all were there, a bunch of cloud companies. This is the second time in 4 months the White House has met with these guys in response, I think, to the feeling that it's costing U.S. businesses a lot of money. And yet we're also hearing people from the NSA say, oh, no, these companies knew we were doing this all along, including the upstream gathering. Let me see if I can find this because it's not in our rundown.
That was a story from Spencer Ackerman in The Guardian, I believe, is the one that you're looking for. And I read that, and all I saw in that story was someone saying all of the tech companies that participated in this program did so with knowledge because they had been handed subpoenas for individual.
Right.
Right. And they were for individual requests to hand over data. And the biggest number that I've seen come up is tens of thousands of emails over the course of 1 year. And that is a far cry from the story that was incorrectly reported last year about the PRISM program allowing the NSA to have direct access to the servers of Google, Facebook, Yahoo, Microsoft, Apple, Skype, and the two others that got thrown in there that nobody even knew about up until that point. There's that story, in my opinion, has been completely discredited and never retracted.
Right.
PRISM was... and that's that. What I think about the situation that we're in now with Snowden's revelations is that we've become almost numb to them, and they're now coming out so fast and furious and so scattered that had they been done skillfully in the beginning to focus on the issues that affecting the privacy of American citizens, where there were probably violations of American law affecting American citizens, you actually had an opportunity to have hearings and legislation to have those specific things addressed. Now it's just become this big mess. The NSA is spying on everyone, and you have situations like you have in your chat room there, where it's basically polarized along party lines, although it's the Snowden party.
Right.
So either you're a Snowden Greenwald defender,
right,
or you're an NSA defender. There's no room for nuance, and especially I don't see any evidence that anyone is making a substantive effort to reform these procedures and change U.S. law. And I think that's a huge lost opportunity.
This though is testimony by the NSA's general counsel, Rajesh D, in front of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which is a board designed by law to give some oversight to the NSA. And he, of course, we know that these companies complied with legal subpoenas. They had to, or national security letters. The issue is, did they also know about upstream collection of communications? That is, communications outside of their own network that, you know, taps into places like
Trojan Level 3. They've been pretty clear that they did not. And that's
they
why
say they did not.
Yes.
And Apple said, we never heard the term PRISM.
That one's a bit of a dodge, because PRISM was actually a program for accessing data in the store after it had been collected. So that's like saying...
Right.
You know, the credit card processing company isn't going to know the name of the program that's running in the bank.
Not. Right.
You know, those are two different things. But I find it nearly impossible to believe that the leaders of any of these companies would willingly allow traffic coming in and out of their data centers to be handed over with no warrant.
Yeah.
You know, that these people in general, the people in the tech industry are fundamentally libertarian. They tilt towards the libertarian side, and they've been dealing with these issues long enough that they know what the effect would be of them, and they know what their legal rights are as well, and they would push back hard on these things. I think that story, if that's the impression that you came away with from it, I didn't see any evidence that that's true in that story. And I don't see any evidence that that's true in anything else that's been revealed so far.
Yeah. In fact, they amended the article to remove statements to that effect. So that was a misstatement by The Guardian.
But there you go. The story got out there.
Right.
It got repeated on Twitter,
right?
And we're not going to talk about how many times it was retweeted. We'll talk about how many times it was seen, because I'll bet it's in the millions of times. You know, you can't take back something like that. So even though journalistically they did the right thing,
it's too late.
Correcting the story, it's too late. The impression is out there, and once again, we've got this situation where people are going to believe what they want to believe, despite the fact that that the available evidence says the exact opposite.
Well done. Thank you, Ed.
Sorry, I get wound up on this.
Yeah, no, in fact, the first time we talked to you about this, that was, you were very clear, and I think you did a very good job of saying this was misreported in the first instance.
Yep.
Boy,
didn't
I hate
mean
to
harsh anyone's
I hate to
buzz there.
Bring up the iPhone 5C at this point. So maybe I think it was very interesting. There's another controversial subject, and we talked about it on this show. The issue of Comcast and Netflix.
That's gotten very interesting now.
Yeah. I had said, yeah, it feels like this is a violation of net neutrality. But then a lot of people responded saying, no, this is business as usual. In fact, we had a guy on Twit from a streaming media site, Dan Rayburn, who was an expert on this, saying, no, this is how business is done with peering on the internet. Well, Reed Hastings, now maybe this is self-serving, but Reed Hastings in his blog called for stronger net neutrality rules and said, in fact, we were squeezed by Comcast. We didn't want to do this. This wasn't
said that net neutrality has been talking about the last mile, and we've got to talk about far, far more upstream from there and have net neutrality apply end to end, which is exactly true.
Yeah. So I guess our initial, it's hard to say, but our initial thoughts about this, that Comcast had turned the knob and slowly decreased Netflix bandwidth over a three-month period in order to squeeze money out of them, were not inaccurate. At least Reed Hastings seems pretty unhappy with the way Comcast, and he also calls out AT&T.
AT&T then responded. So now we're where we always are, which with net neutrality.
He said, she said.
Yeah. And what we need is government and the FCC to step in and protect, hello, folks, us.
Well, you know what's fascinating about this to me? I think Jeff Jarvis is absolutely right about this. We do need the government involved in it. We have people who have created a paradise of capitalism on the internet, taking it away as much as possible from delivery mechanisms, pipes and tubes that are owned and controlled by the people and not for profit, and handed them over to profit-making organizations. And now we are surprised that there's huge money in different segments of the network and that people are arguing over who gets to divvy up our money. And the only, you know, the genie went out of the bottle a long time ago when the internet was privatized. And I can't decide whether I should laugh or cry at the capitalists who are seeing, be careful what you wish for in action.
So in the AT&T public policy blog, Jim Ciccone writes that Reed Hastings is arrogant. He says, we all know there's no such thing as a free lunch and there is no cost-free delivery of streaming movies. Someone has to pay that cost. Mr. Hastings' arrogant proposition is that everyone else should pay but Netflix. That may be a nice deal if he can get it, but it's not how the internet or telecommunication, for that matter, has ever worked. Yeah, it really is a he said, she said. I feel like we pay for Netflix to AT&T, to Comcast, by buying bandwidth from them. Netflix pays for its bandwidth through its providers, and it seems like putting up a toll on the road that prevents Netflix from getting to us, its customers, when Comcast says you got to pay extra. But there's a lot of technical mumbo jumbo.
There's a lot of technical stuff involved here. There's, yeah. You know, people have been using CDNs, content delivery networks, for a long time to insulate themselves from the costs of sudden spikes in traffic, right? Because the CDNs have been paying for this stuff all along. And I am not up to speed on all the issues involved here, but I do know that Netflix has had longstanding relationships with the CDNs and now are big enough to essentially be a CDN of their own.
Right. Well, in fact, they have an Open Connect system right. designed to do that. In fact, Cablevision's a participant. Hastings writes in his blog post, some major ISPs like Cablevision already practice strong net neutrality, and for their broadband subscribers, the quality of Netflix and other streaming services is outstanding. But on other big ISPs, due to a lack of sufficient interconnectivity, Netflix performance has been constrained, subjecting customers who pay a lot of money for high-speed internet to high buffering rates, long wait times, and poor video quality. He says once Netflix agrees to pay the ISP interconnect fees, which they have agreed with Comcast, sufficient capacity is made available and high-quality service is restored. If this kind of leverage is effective against Netflix, imagine the plight of smaller services today and in the future. He calls it an arbitrary tax. It is complicated, and I don't know which side I fall in. I've gone back and forth on this a couple of times. It's probably a little much for us to understand, but try.
The way I put it in public parts at the end is that if any bit is stopped, detoured, or slowed down along the way to its destination, then no bit can be presumed to be free. All bits are created equal on the net.
Yeah.
Full stop. That's the principle.
It seems to me that's pretty basic.
Yep. And so the argument, but video costs more. Okay. Well, people are using video, figure it out. But there's going to be other applications that come down the line. And we don't know what this net thing is yet. And it's a strategic necessity of the country to grow the capacity of the net. And if we get hung up just over some stupid videos when there's so much more data to be had out there, more that can be done, we're holding up our future. So that's why, I want competition. I agree that that's the way to make this work in the long run. But right now we don't have competition, so it's time for government to step in and uphold some principles.
So it turns out Microsoft might be reading your email. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. I'm sure Ed will have something to say on that story. But first, let's take a look at what you might have missed, if you missed anything this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit.
What?
Tech news today.
Well, after admitting to snooping on a blogger's email, Microsoft announced today a change in its privacy policy. I would like to call out Microsoft and demand that they apologize. Everybody thinks that it's okay to violate the privacy of people for their own objectives.
All about Android.
Android Wear is Google's version of Android for wearable computers.
He's pretty much flipping his lid as he watches this video.
I can't contain myself. This is like so cool.
Any software that makes people dance a little bit more, that's good software right there.
Security Now.
1 month from today, XP Armageddon. It's a rock solid OS.
Yeah, but so, if they're no longer being patched, then it no longer is rock solid.
It's not the operating system that is the problem.
Know-how. In this episode of Know-How, we're taking your feedback, then we're going to show you the best way to have a mobile podcasting rig and field audio.
Twit. It's not your father's Twit.
I love scaring Sarah Lane. I do. Let's see what's coming up in the week ahead, Mr.
Coming up this week, Macworld, officially called Macworld/iWorld. The show happens March 27th through the 29th in San Francisco. Ad Tech also happens this week and also in San Francisco. Watch for our special coverage of Macworld this week. And also join me on Tech News Today all week with guest co-anchors Donna Tam, Stephen Shanklin, Elise Hu, and Jessica Lesson. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Mike Elgin. TNT every Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. 1700 UTC. Something else coming up this week, March 27th. Microsoft has invited a select few. Ed, I bet you were invited.
Invited to what, Leo?
A special event.
You know what? I did not get an invitation to that event. Huh. I think they didn't. I think it's going to be streamed live, and I think they knew that.
You're coming from a long way. But apparently, Satya Nadella will do his first public event as CEO of Microsoft in San Francisco on the 27th. Most experts agree it will be an announcement of iPads, Microsoft Office for the iPad. Yes, you agree?
Sounds like a good rumor.
Microsoft, it's interesting because they seem to really want to go all touch. There also was a rumor that they would show their all touch version of Office for Metro at the same time.
I would suspect that I absolutely do not have any special knowledge about what's going to be at this event, but I think the rumors are probably correct.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that the architecture of the product is designed so that it will, so you could take that, the basic building blocks of it, and then code them to run on Windows touch devices and on iOS touch devices, and probably in very short order on Android touch-based devices.
Yeah.
Either. I mean, I think the UI on a square or a rectangular touchscreen is, you know, going to work pretty much the same either way. So they should be able to demonstrate one. If they do introduce an iPad version before a Windows version, I think it will be a big, I think it will shut up a lot of the people who have been saying Microsoft refuses to let go of its cash cow, Windows.
Well, people have been thinking that maybe they were holding back on the iOS version of Office because they didn't want to disadvantage Surface. But I think it just took them that long to do. They also have this codename Gemini, this touch first version of Office. I bet we'll see a little bit of both. That's Thursday. It's 10 a.m. Pacific. We will cover that live as well. Mike Elgin will be there and covering it. We will stream it for you. Also, another thing coming up this week, Verizon will be announcing the new HTC One, the M8 version of the HTC One. I believe that's Tuesday, and I think we will have a first look at it Tuesday on Before You Buy, Tuesday afternoon on Before You Buy. Oh. I expect to have an M8 in hand. I'm a big fan of the HTC One, so I'm looking forward to that. So Microsoft apparently read email without a court order. What's the story, Ed?
So I did a post on this last week, and I have another post that I think I'll publish tonight that's around 1,500 words on the subject. I've been looking at it pretty carefully. Here's the executive summary. The FBI filed a criminal complaint in federal court last week against a former Microsoft employee. They arrested him in Seattle at roughly the same time that they filed that complaint, and he's being held right now without bail. And they charged him with leaking not just pre-release Microsoft code, but of leaking the software development kit and binary code for Microsoft's Activation Server. And that's the product that generates and validates the product keys for Windows and Office. And it is literally the linchpin of a multi-billion dollar business.
Yeah, those are the crown jewels.
So,
but the good news is he really liked Microsoft products.
He really liked Microsoft products because he uploaded the files to Microsoft SkyDrive and then used Windows Live Messenger or MSN Messenger at the time and Hotmail to coordinate with a guy in France. And I do not want to call him a journalist, and I'm reluctant to even call him a blogger, although that's what he was called in the FBI
He's
complaint.
A Windows enthusiast.
Yeah, he was, I think in the story that I'm publishing tonight, I think I called him a software pirate with good connections, a penchant for tweaking authority, and really bad operational security skills.
Uh-oh, we lost him again. We lost your audio again. Put that button that you hit. Ho, ho, wait. Hey. Hey, did we lose yours too?
No, I'm here. I'm just trying to signal to him.
Hey, Ed. Hey, you. We're missing the story. Yeah.
There we go.
He's using Skype. That's the problem. He's also using a Microsoft product.
Yeah.
He used a Hotmail email address. Sorry. Hey, there you go. So we were talking about Kanuna, who he's like Ev Leaks. He's one of these guys who's famous for leaking code and leaking stuff like this.
This is all allegedly, right?
All allegedly.
Yeah, although I think there's enough evidence here that you can put allegedly in quotes.
Right.
I mean, this is, you know, the man gets his day, this guy, Kib Kahlo, gets his day in court, and he gets to put up a defense, and he is indeed innocent until proven guilty. But there is a hell of a lot of evidence against him at this point.
Had he used Dropbox or Google Drive, Microsoft would have had to subpoena or get a court order to get this information.
But and they would have been able to get it in a heartbeat.
Right, right.
But the thing is, they need to
because in their terms of services, it says they reserve the right to review content.
Well, it's not just the terms of service to me. This is the story that I'm publishing tonight. This was not a case of Microsoft trying to figure out what happened by going and reading somebody's mail.
Right.
The Microsoft account, there was a crime in progress.
Right.
And that was where it was happening.
Right.
Stolen code was being transferred on Microsoft's servers, the servers it owned and controlled. The vehicle that was being used to transport stolen property across state lines and international borders was Microsoft's Hotmail and Messenger services. Now, guess what? When Apple, back a couple of years ago, had some of their trade secrets taken away from them by Gizmodo, they got a court order, and the San Mateo County Sheriff's Department, you know, knocked down a guy's door and took away his computers.
Yeah.
Now, had that guy had the phone sitting in a desk at Apple's headquarters, they could have just walked in, right, you know, to open his desk. And that's really the situation that we have here. There was clear, incontrovertible evidence of stolen property. They knew who the guy was, and they went in and interrupted a crime in progress. Now, I think it's a big
Microsoft
leap.
Microsoft's Deputy General Counsel John Frank writes, courts do not issue orders authorizing someone to search themselves.
And he's absolutely right. The reason you have to go to court and get a court order is so that you can take it to Dropbox or Google, mm-hmm, or Yahoo or Apple or whoever and say and compel them to turn over the contents of a server that they control.
And nevertheless, I understand people's kind of concern about this, as does Microsoft.
Right.
And it's been pointed out that both Google and Apple have similar terms in their terms of service.
Everyone does. You have to. The reason that Lavabit, Ed Snowden's email provider, shut down last year was because there is no way to
not do it.
If you send email through a server that somebody else owns, they're going to have access to it. And so what you have to do is you have to have processes, and you have to have really good processes in place. The much bigger risks for people, frankly, are not that Microsoft is going to poke through your email or that and the NSA is going to. The much bigger risk is that a rogue employee is going to start going through email randomly and using it to commit identity theft or to blackmail people or whatever.
So what Microsoft said, this is in your blog post, and I think it's very interesting, going forward to ensure they comply with standards applicable to obtaining a court order, they're going to actually have a judge. As an additional step, as we go forward, we'll submit this evidence to an outside attorney who is a former federal judge. And we will conduct such a search only if this former judge similarly concludes there is evidence sufficient for a court order. They're going to act as if they need a court order, which I think is appropriate.
And the EFF called that warrants for Windows, which I thought was pretty clever. The thing is here, we're in uncharted territory in some ways here. I really do think these were extraordinary circumstances. Hotmail's been around 18 years. Gmail has been around, I think it's going to celebrate its 10th anniversary this year. Yahoo Mail has been around for 19 or even 20 years. There are almost no cases that have come up like this because the facts involved where someone is using a company's free services to steal potentially multi-million and probably billions of dollars worth of trade secrets from that company, that doesn't exist. And Microsoft did go through a process that's very similar to what they described they're going through. Everything was documented here. It had to be signed off by the chief counsel for the company. Nonetheless, I understand why people are upset by this. I also find it difficult to believe that somebody thinks that this is something that could happen to anyone else tomorrow. The set of facts are so extraordinary that...
I think we should also underscore the fact that if you think email is private in any way, you're crazy. That you, if you're, you know, the only safe way to, secure way to communicate with people over the internet is to use point-to-point encryption. Mm-hmm. And if you're not using that, then you might as well treat it like a postcard.
I agree with that. I think that's an important thing for everyone to understand. But I think it's also important for people to have a reasonable expectation that people handling their email, their phone communications, their instant messaging, any kind of video chats, any of those things, they have a reasonable expectation that the company they've contracted with to do that is going to exercise more than reasonable, more than prudent care over the privacy of
Leo. I think it rises to a different level. I think, and I've said this on Twig, I think we've got to get to the point where there's a principle of law that says that private communications are private unless, and that the same protection that's given to your first class mail should be given to email and chats and Skype calls and phone calls and so on. And obviously, cops and spies don't like it. But with the death of the first class letter, you have Jimmy Carter this week saying that he still uses mail because he can't trust the internet. Then there's no means of private communication that is given a legal guarantee of privacy.
Had Kip Kahlo taken the printouts and put them in an envelope and mailed it to this French blogger, it would be a federal offense to open it. Mm-hmm. You would have to get a court order.
Right.
Yeah, you would. You would.
And it would have been done through an agency that was outside of Microsoft's control where they could have where they could have done that. There are a bunch of facts we do not know about this case as well. But I think the biggest thing, the thing that people are really misunderstanding, is that this was Microsoft going in and targeting someone and reading their email to snoop on them. This was a crime in progress. Yeah.
No, I think we understand. I think had Microsoft not made such a big deal about Gmail Man and Scroogled, people might be a little bit less anxious to jump on them. But they made such a big deal about how Google reads your email that it just kind of, I think it touched a nerve.
It's the usual Microsoft bad taste in the mouth.
Yeah. Oh, please.
But they had to do what they did, and they did what it did. It was not unreasonable, and they did it right.
I think, this. It's also extraordinarily relevant to point out that this happened in summer of 2012, 9 months before Ed Snowden. Right. Had this happened the month after Ed Snowden, a lot of concern for the optics of it would have been very different.
Yes.
I'm going to disagree. I'm going to disagree. This privacy stuff about email and big tech companies has been around before Snowden.
Well, okay.
Russell Brandom wrote on the right on the Verge, Microsoft just exposed email's ugliest secret. It's more broken than you think. Every email company reserves the right to do this and can.
Yeah, but I think it's important to say, and I'll say this: I'll be sending. If anybody in Google PR or technical operations wants to contact me, you can do that on Twitter right there. I'd like to talk to you about the processes that you have in place to protect confidentiality of your customers' information. The one organization where I do know how it works is Microsoft's facility for its paid customers of Office 365, Exchange Online, and Dynamics CRM. And there, there's only a handful of people in the organization who have access to content. Nobody else even can get to it. They're not allowed to get there. Access is restricted by biometric control, and every single access of anything that has to do with customer content is logged with the employee's name, the reason for it, and the time. Those logs are saved for a number of years, I'm not sure how many, and they're randomly audited by internal and external people at regular intervals. I bring that up for Microsoft only because it's the one that I happen to know, but I am certain that Apple and Google and Yahoo, just to name three, have equally rigorous data protection procedures in place in their data centers, because you cannot do that in the year 2014. You cannot be anything less than rigorous with that kind of protection.
We're going to take a break. We come back. We have a few more things to talk about. I didn't get to Android Wear. We will get to that in a second. And also an article in New Scientist, which shows that using DNA alone, you can create a very accurate mugshot. That's scary. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about those. Audible, our guest, our sponsor for this portion of the show. I have talked about Audible so many times. You know I'm a major Audible fanatic. Audible is the source of audio books and entertainment, the best in the world, 150,000 titles. If you like science fiction, if you like mysteries, if you like history, if you like to learn, there's no better place to go than audible.com. And I'm going to get you two books right now. When you go to audible.com/twit2, you'll be signing up for the Platinum Plan. That's two books a month, plus the audio digest of the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times Daily. Before you see the movie, you probably should read the book. By the way, Audible has great young adult fiction. This is Divergent, about to be a major motion picture. But they have a fabulous selection of young adult. And if you've got a young adult in your family, or you are a young adult, but if you have a young adult in your family and you want to get them reading, you might say, oh, I don't think listening is going to be the same. Many a study has shown this is a great way to get kids reading. They listen, then they want to read because they get excited about books. This is one of the greatest books of all time. I listened to this with Henry, The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak. Fabulous. So, you know, just remember, Audible is more than just, you know, the bestsellers. It goes deep. Classics. Anne Hathaway reading The Wizard of Oz. That sounds awesome, huh? The Johnny Ive book by Leander Cani. Silence of the Lambs, 25th Anniversary Edition. Frank Muller is one of their best readers. Boy, he brings that to life. These books become movies in your mind. You see them as they happen. Terry Pratchett has book 40 of the Discworld series out. And Terry, who's suffering from Alzheimer's, worked really hard to get this book out. And I just praise him for continuing to write. And I am a huge fan of all the Discworld books. I've read every one of them. Of course, I'm going to get the new one, Raising Steam. Just came out on Audible. And I'll just play a little of Stephen Briggs' narration because he's such a good narrator.
The people of the town were quite accustomed to the clangings and bangings emanating every day from the various blacksmith forges for which the area was famous. It seemed that even though he had set up a forge of his own, young Simnel had decided not to enter the blacksmithing trade.
These are comedic fantasy fiction, sci fiction novels that are just awesome. If you haven't read any of the Discworld, I highly recommend all of the Discworlds. I think all of them are available on audible.com. Terry Pratchett's one of my favorite authors. There's so much good stuff here. So much good stuff. It's hard to pick two, but do, because you're going to be very, very glad you did. You've got 30 days free. You quit in the first 30 days. Those books are yours to keep. You will pay nothing. And they've got self-help stuff, too. The Power of Forgetting, 6 Skills to Clear Out Brain Clutter. I need that. I've got a lot of clutter in there. Audible.com/twit2 to get your two books. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter, audible_com, for a lot of great, great suggestions. That's one of the things you see with Audible. You see Audible listeners, when they get together, they go, what do you listen to? What do you like? And we do that a lot on all of our shows because many of our hosts, including Paul Thurrott and Andy Iannacco and myself, are major Audible fans. Audible.com/twit2. Try it today. We talked a lot about it on This Week in Google, all about Android. Android Wear, it's an SDK that Google has released to support wearable computers. Motorola and LG both announced watches. I was very interested in the Moto 360. I'm already a Moto X fan. And this is round, which seems, cool. Wow, a round wristwatch. What an idea. But Google now cards on it. And there's a lot more we don't know about. In fact, Mike Elgin wrote a great article in Computer World, 15 things we would like to know about this, including battery life, you know, how it works. But the idea, and people are very excited about the idea of Google now cards on a wristwatch that looks like a real watch.
the dork factor goes down considerably.
Yeah, I mean, I would not be embarrassed to wear that at all. It's thick. You can tell it's a little thick.
It's kind of clunky.
Oh, but it's not as clunky as like the gear.
Well, some of these cool watches are gigantic.
Yeah, I mean, it's big, and if you
I think you're arguing there that you chose a cooler character to dress as.
It's not as
for
ugly.
Your visit to Comic-Con.
Yeah, it's not as well, ugly. Right, it's fair, not right. as geeky. You're right. I have a cooler character on my wrist. I don't know. I'm excited about it. We'll have to see. Summer 2014 could be anything from June through September, but I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. What do you think? We've talked a lot about this Week in Google. In fact, I even opined that I didn't really think Google intended to make Google Glass a product. It was merely a way to gather data points about what people want to do with wearables, and that really makes much more sense for Google to make a wearable platform that everybody else develops for.
I think so.
Yeah.
They might still make demonstration.
And I am wearing this to Comic-Con. So there, Ed Bott. So there.
Well, there's a lot of room for innovation in this space.
Yeah.
To be sure.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're going to know the winner or the winners anytime soon. This looks interesting. But Google also has a history of releasing beautiful products that, you know, go nowhere. That the hi-fi thing they did, remember?
Yeah, the Q.
You know, the Q.
Yeah, I mean, but that was really expensive.
Yeah,
I think that's
the exception, Ed. I think you know, I have my Nexus 5 and Nexus 7 and Chromebook in front of me, and these are fine products.
I agree with that. They've done great phones and tablets. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to be disagreeable here, but what those products that you point to there they came along in the aftermath of other products which established the category and what the category should do. So you had iPhone and iPad, and those came along after that. A Chromebook is a laptop that basically runs the Google browser.
I have no problem being disagreeable. That's what I do. And with a slight fever, I'm channeling Dvorak now. the notion of a 7-inch tablet, Steve Jobs made fun of, that was pioneered by Google.
I agree.
The notion of a cloud-only computer, that's more than just a laptop. Screw Microsoft's marketing. That's pioneered by Google.
I was skeptical about the Chromebook, but I have to say I've come around quite a bit.
I think we're starting to see more and more products that are more interesting. I think we're going to see yet more coming down. The Asus C720P looks like a very interesting machine. There's more coming down the line.
All of those things is that they're very, very logical extensions of things that already existed.
I agree.
And I'm not saying that they copied them. I'm not saying that they, you know, that there wasn't tremendous innovation involved in them. My point is that I don't think anyone has established what a watch, what a computing watch does yet. That to me is the thing. So I think Apple could just as easily come out with something and fail with it because
we don't know. But I can tell you,
that's my only point about
it. If it has features of the Moto X where I could say, okay, Google now to my Moto X and talk to it, have it do stuff. If I could say, how do I navigate? If I can send a text. And we've seen in the videos, it looks like you'd be able to respond to a text by lifting your watch and responding. Those things could be very, very valuable. I think that Apple seems to be, or looks to be, given on its hires, focusing on the health aspects of a bracelet. Google seems to be focusing on the Google Now. And I'll tell you what, this is where Google has an advantage because there's a barrier to entry here. They own all this data about us. Now, admittedly, people are nervous about it. But the fact is that Google, because you do your searches through them, you have your calendar there, you have your contacts there. There's something they can do with Google Now cards that nobody else can do. Maybe Microsoft can with Bing and Bing services, but they're playing catch up on this one. And Microsoft, by the way, did this. They did a spot watch. We all remember it.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of a product that didn't exactly fly into the center.
I had one. The real problem for Google is crossing that creepy line and how they... And speaking of the creepy line, look at this. This is a study done by a population geneticist at the Pennsylvania State University, Mark Shriver, and an imaging specialist, Peter Claes, at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium. They captured data points from 600 volunteers of mixed ancestry, mapped their facial features based on 76 genetic variants, and came up with a way to model somebody's face with just their genome. And here's the interesting thing. This is a reporter at New Scientist who wrote this article. She gave them her 23andMe profile. That's all. And you got to say, these mugshots are pretty accurate.
But face at what age?
Well,
determine that?
That's a good question, because obviously the genes could be. They say we're a few years off, but in 5 to 10 years, we'll be able to computationally predict a face based on a genome. Whoa. Imagine how that'll change law enforcement. We're going to have to really kind of get rid of those. Don't want to leave those genome traces behind.
It would also be interesting, though. Imagine me that would go back and see what Richard III really looked like.
Wow. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Although the pre-crime department will be able to go back and do pre-mugshots.
Yeah. Hey, this was a lot of fun. I want to thank both of our guests today. Ed Bott is always great. We have two of my favorite prickly guys here. And that is what makes a great twit. That's what makes a great
twit.
Glad
you made that into an adjective, Leo.
Prickly?
The prickly is a noun.
Yeah. Well, okay, you're right. It's better an adjective than a noun. Now I get what you're talking about. But I am glad you were here. Because frankly, there is an awful lot of just general chorus of agreement about every news story in tech these days. And it's nice to hear people who think for themselves and actually get us to wake up a little bit. So thank you very much for being here. Ed Bott, you can read his stuff on ZDNet.com. The Ed Bott Report.
Thanks, Leo.
Yeah, always a pleasure. You can catch Jeff Jarvis every week on This Week in Google. He's a regular on the show every Wednesday, but you can also follow him at his blog, buzzmachine.com, read his books, Public Parts, the most recent. Follow him on Twitter, Google+.
Both on Audible, and also let's mention, since Audible's a sponsor of this show, Gutenberg the Geek on Audible. If you're a member, I think you get it for free.
Oh, how could I have left? You should have jumped right into that ad.
So search
for Jeff Jarvis on Audible and you will find it all, including a freebie if you're an Audible member.
I think it is.
99 cents.
99 cents. Okay.
Still, that's practically free. And you did the reading. Actually, you've done the reading on all of them.
Oh, torturing Audible producers.
How could I have left that out? Thank you, Jeff. We'll see you Wednesday.
Yes.
It'll be an interesting This Week in Google, because if we do the Google Hangout, it will be at 11 o'clock that morning, 2 p.m. your time, and then we'll immediately follow that Google Hangout with This Week in Google, you and Gina Trapani, and perhaps we'll get some clips from Vince Cerf talking about the internet.
That'd be great.
The future of the internet. I think it should be really
important topic.
Yeah, no kidding. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon right at the end of the tech news week, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC on twit.tv. Please watch live. We love it if you do, but if you can't watch live, we make on-demand audio and video available after the fact. Just go to twit.tv or subscribe, on iTunes, Dogcatcher, Instacast, Stitcher. That list is getting longer and longer. We're on Roku. We're everywhere. Just make sure you watch the show, because we work hard on it. Thanks to Chad Johnson, our producer, for the old redhead.
Yay, Chad.
He does on this.
Three guys with white hair and one with red hair.
Yeah. And our total age together equals nothing.
My total age multiplied by three.
10.
Yeah.
Or something. I don't know. Hey, thank you, everybody, for joining us. Another twit.
This is
in the can. Thank you, everybody. Nice live audience today, too.
Yay. Twit, baby. Doing the twit. All right. Doing the twit, baby.